From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM later on tonight. Open lines for you. Here's what's happening. President Donald Trump believes millions of votes were cast illegally in last year's election, but he would not provide any concrete evidence for that claim, which has long been debunked. I thought we'd check in with online columnist Dr. John Curtis to get his take on this story that's been going on all day. John, first of all, if they were illegal, he claims then that's why Hillary got the popular vote. What do you think? What's going on?
Well, I think he's reading Breitbart News a little bit too often these days for obvious reasons. But, to what extent the illegal vote, had an influence on the election, I think is, it's impossible to tell. I don't think anybody has any kind of definitive data on it. I think the clear message with Trump is that if he doesn't, if he's not congratulated for, I think it really irks him that Hillary got the popular vote, even though that he had essentially an electoral college, not a landslide exactly, but he had almost as many votes as Reagan did back in 1980. And, and he's being just whipsawed by the mainstream news media. His press secretary, Sean Spicer, is just being beaten up already, by the media, asking a variety of questions, all designed to sort of delegitimize the Trump presidency. So I think, what you're going to get with Trump, and I think this is, everybody's wondering, when is he going to put his presidential hat on? And I've cautioned people not to hold their breath too long. I think what you see with Trump, with the tweeting, with the sensitivity to the kind of disinformation that goes on in the mainstream media about him and his quirky sort of explanations for things at times, I think this is what people can expect for the duration of his presidency, however long it lasts. And remember what we talked about, that a group of ethics scholars are filing suit in federal court, basically, which is not going to go anywhere too much. But it's to talk about how Trump and his business dealings in Europe, his multinational business dealings, violate the emolument clause of the Constitution that essentially says that presidents cannot take money from foreign governments. And of course, when it comes to Trump's golf courses and resorts and hotels, it's quite a stretch when you think about it to consider, since everybody knew that he had these businesses before he was elected, right now to start slamming him with breaching the Constitution. But you can expect more of Trump's reactions in the future.
I think you're right, John. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. In Los Angeles, police are investigating the killing of an internationally known hairdresser and beauty company executive. His name's Fabio Cimentilli. He was found beaten and stabbed at a Los Angeles home. Detectives did not immediately provide a possible motive for that murder. Police say an eastern Pennsylvania man beat his mother and choked her to almost the point of unconsciousness for changing the television channel. The 42-year-old man has been jailed on assault and harassment charges after the argument Sunday night in their home. My gosh. Scientists will measure Mount Everest to determine whether a massive earthquake in Nepal really did knock an inch off the world's tallest peak. They're actually going to go out there and check this out. A deadly 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck Nepal back in 2015, killing thousands and altering the landscape across the Himalayan nation. Satellite data at the time suggested the impact of the quake reduced Everest peak, and so they're going to go check that. Genetically modified apples will make their U.S. debut next month. The apples, altered to decompose more slowly, will be sold in a pilot program in 10 grocery stores in the Midwest. I thought it was time to check in with Jeffrey Smith, an international best-selling author, about genetic roulette. He knows all about GMOs. Jeffrey, apples?
I wouldn't touch them, George. Don't eat them.
An apple a day keeps the doctor away.
They're going to be golden delicious, 10 stores in the Midwest, and in February and March. Don't eat them.
Just so they don't brown up a little bit?
That's what they're doing, and they're using something called double-stranded RNA. And what it is little pieces of RNA that match in their sequence with the apple's DNA to silence the gene that produces the browning effect. Now, we know that if you feed double-stranded RNA to humans, it might also reprogram our DNA. They tried an experiment with honeybees, and they didn't think it would have any effect whatsoever. They fed him one meal of double-stranded RNA, a different variety, and it changed the regulation of over 1,400 genes. That's about 10% of the genome of the honeybee, which means that if you eat this Arctic apple, which you should avoid, it might theoretically turn off genes inside your body, and you'll never know, and it also may change genes even later on, because some of these honeybees, they didn't have the change for certain genes until weeks later. So it could be like a ticking genetic time bomb.
Now, are we going to know that these apples are in the stores when people go shopping?
Well, they're not going to announce which stores, that they're going to leave it up to the stores themselves. They're also not going to announce that they're genetically engineered on the package. They're just going to have what's called a QR code, that little square thing, big pixels. But it'll say Arctic. If it says Arctic apples and it's golden delicious, tell the store owners to get rid of them. It's very, very dangerous. In fact, I spoke to someone who was basically hounded out of the USDA. He was basically a whistleblower and was essentially kicked out because he was blowing the whistle on these type of things. He wrote a paper saying that they did not have the regulatory capabilities of testing all the things that could go wrong with this double-stranded RNA. And he was entirely ignored, and the USDA went ahead and allowed these apples on the market thereafter.
All right, Jeff, we're going to follow up with you on this story. Jeez, golden delicious apples, they're going to be altered, GMO. You heard Jeffrey Smith. By the way, I just did a taping with Jeffrey for Beyond Belief. You'll be able to find that at beyondbelief.com in an upcoming episode. An amendment to Alaska's divorce statutes, which took effect last week, is making waves in the world of the animal law. It makes Alaska the first state in the country to require courts to take into consideration the well-being of the animal in a divorce and to explicitly empower judges to assign joint custody of pets. In a blog post, the Animal Legal Defense Fund called the well-being provision groundbreaking and unique. If you've ever gone through this situation, the pet does really get emotional here. China is spending $138 million on a new initiative to solve the drought in its northwestern provinces. Listen to what they're doing. It's sending airplanes to spray chemicals like dry ice and silver iodide across the sky to create more rainfall in a technique called cloud seeding. The China Meteorological Administration expects rainfall and snow to be increased over the area. How about that? Up next, we're going to talk about the secret state, a history of intelligence and espionage. John Hughes Wilson joins us live from the United Kingdom next. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Colonel John Hughes Wilson, one of Britain's leading military historians, an author, broadcaster, commentator on a wide range of intelligence and military historical subjects. Now, after initial service as an infantry officer with the Sherwood Foresters during his 25 years in the Intelligence Corps and as a Special Forces Operation Officer, he saw active service in the Falkland Islands, Cyprus, Arabia, and Northern Ireland, as well as some dangerous jungles of Whitehall and NATO. While retiring from the Army, he has traveled and lectured extensively. He's written several books, including JFK, An American Coup d'Etat, the book we're talking about tonight, The Secret State, A History of Intelligence and Espionage. Fascinating book, John. Well done, by the way.
George, thank you very much. That's very kind. Can I just ask you a question? What time is it with you?
Right now, I'm in Los Angeles. It's right. Coming up on 10:19 p.m.
Right. Well, here in North Cyprus, which is where I live, it's just gone 9:15 in the morning.
Wow. When did you go off to Cyprus?
Well, I served in Cyprus back in 1974 when they had the war here between the Greeks and the Turks.
Yeah.
with the UN, and I liked it so much that I always said when I retired, we'd try to come back to Cyprus. So here we are.
It's a gorgeous area, isn't it?
It is, and one of the ironies is we are living in the middle of this great arc of trouble. Turkey, Lebanon, Israel,
oh my
Syria,
God, yeah.
Egypt, nothing but mayhem. But here in Cyprus, it's a zone, or it's like the eye of the hurricane.
Well, that's good. That's good. Do you think they're going to ever get the situation in that region resolved?
No, I don't think so. I think we're living through now. Back in Europe in the 1600s, there was what they called the 30 Years' War on the continent of Europe between the Catholics and the Protestants as part of the Reformation and the great punch-up that happened after that. And we had that 30 Years' War, religious war. I think we're now seeing the Islamic version of that between Shia Islam and Sunni Islam as they slug it out, the Persians in Tehran, the Saudi Arabians, and I think it's going to be a long haul.
What is the take, John, on our brand-new president, Donald Trump, out there?
Well, he's really had a bad press, partly brought about by his own utterances, I think. But at the end of the day, he's the American president with all that entails. He's theoretically the most powerful man in the world. And Britain has always been a staunch ally of America for a variety of reasons. And I think it behoves us to get behind the president, whether you like him or you hate him. And you made a comment earlier that I thought was very shrewd, or one of your broadcasters did. He said, there's a massive attempt going on to delegitimize Donald Trump. Well, I think that's unfair. Give the guy at least 100 days to set his stall out.
Sure. I was saying that last night too, John. Give the guy a chance. Let's let him fail or let him succeed, but give him
Correct.
A chance.
Yep.
So let's talk about the secret state. I love history. You've done a marvelous job digging deep into the intelligence. And then we're going to lead up to where you think we are today with the intelligence, because it's changed dramatically, I think, over the years. But how did you get into this business?
Well, I was, as I say, or as you said in the introduction, for which many thanks, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Now my mother's dead, it means I've got two fans.
You've got more than that, believe me.
But I was an infantry officer. I was about to leave the army because my regiment was being disbanded as the last or the next round of British Army defense cuts to save money. And the intelligence corps came up and tapped me on the shoulder, and I was selected for the intelligence corps. Much, I have to say, to my own and my friends' amazement.
And then the writing career, how did that start?
Well, when I came out, I went into business in Brussels, and I was the worst businessman in the world, George. I was awful. I was very good at getting business, but, of course, being an ex-military guy, I trusted civilians when they said they'd pay me, and they didn't. And I lost, I suppose, the best part of, put in U.S. terms, $200,000.
A lot of money.
My tail between my legs. And a friend of mine actually said to me, would I write a book? So I sat down for 6 weeks and scribbled what was in my head. And it became a bestseller, Military Intelligence Blunders. And it's now a textbook in some universities.
Well, look, your writing is phenomenal. At some point tonight, I do want to ask you a little bit about JFK and the work that you did there, because that's a subject that is very, very fascinating to me, and we'll do that. Now, this work here, you know, the little introduction we had, the James Bond theme, of course, made the intelligence community during those movies look just phenomenal, like they couldn't do wrong. Where is the intelligence community today, both the United States and the Brits?
Right. The answer to that is James Bond, of course, is a joke. In the terms of it shows the sort of glamorous world that Ian Fleming would have liked it to have been.
Mm-hmm.
He was that kind of guy. But the real world of intelligence nowadays is much more on the technical side. You still need human intelligence. You'll always need spies. For the whole of life, you'll need spies. And let's face it, we all collect intelligence. We collect intelligence information, call it what you like, in the family, in the school, in the workplace. Nations do it on each other all the time. We all have to have input, information. So that's a given forever. But the way we're doing it has changed dramatically. And I think in the First World War, we saw the birth of primitive signals intelligence, aerial photography, and that all blossoms in the Second World War, where we bring in electronic intelligence, radar, being able to pick up bombers in the night. And that's followed by the Cold War, which has just exploded into satellites. Much more, I think, dangerous, perhaps, potentially dangerous, is the birth of the surveillance state, where organizations like your National Security Agency and Britain's Government Communications HQ, GCHQ, now have the technology and the computers and the digital punch to listen to everybody anywhere all the time. And when you put that on with things like CCTV cameras for your security, sir, of course you understand, not to monitor, to actually help you. There's some truth in that. And suddenly we're in a surveillance state, and we really need to think through the implications of that for the future, because we can't disinvent it.
John, where are things like WikiLeaks standing in terms of information and intelligence? Because to me, the hacking and the WikiLeaks are probably doing as good a job in intelligence as agents are.
Yes, that's true. And I think we have to look at the source of those very carefully. For example, I think in the book I call him the appalling Assange. We get this extraordinary business of this very strange young man in the U.S. Army who's now had a sex change operation.
Chelsea Manning.
That's the one, Chelsea. Bradley Manning. Chelsea.
Right, Bradley was his first name, that's right.
That's right. He's now Chelsea. He is really unsupervised by the United States Army intelligence side, and because he's bored, because we don't know his motivation, he collects these 700,000 different digital pieces of intelligence, and he then passes them on. Again, his motive is unclear, to Assange. Now, Assange is a self-publicist. He's looking to make a buck. He goes public with this stuff, and he's then in the position of offense. And I don't know if it's the same in America, but offence in Britain stands for a purveyor of stolen goods.
Yep, that's same thing here.
That's exactly what Assange is. And, of course, the feds come for him, and he does a runner because he's very frightened, leaving poor old Bradley Manning, Chelsea, to take the rap. And that's wrong. But that's a criminal matter.
By the way, just had his sentence commuted by President then Obama.
Yes, I saw that.
So that's going to be shortened. He'll be out, I believe, in May now.
That's right. And, of course, you're now seeing crime rewarded. Whether that was some sort of sop towards the lesbian gay community to look good by Obama, I don't know. But it's actually, I think, a mistake because it sends the wrong message. Then we turn, George, to the really important one, and that's this guy, Edward Snowden.
Just going to ask you about him.
Yeah, now Snowden's much different case. Snowden is a very clever guy. He's working for the NSA and various contractors, and we're back to the surveillance state. He discovers that the feds, the government, are actually doing a lot of things that are against the U.S. Constitution.
That's right. Illegalities. Many. That's right.
Gathering intelligence on citizens. Now, that's in America, that's against the law, the way it was going on. He then goes to see his bosses, I think, four times, and says, "We've got a problem here, boss. We really are breaking the law, and it's wrong." And he gets the equivalent of being patted on the head and told, there, don't worry a little head about it. Don't you worry about it. So eventually, torn, it would appear from what he said, by doubts, problems, he thinks he has to go public and reveal that the American government is breaking its own laws and spying on its own citizens. Now, the question we have to ask ourselves, and every American has to ask himself, is Snowden a traitor, or is he a whistleblower?
Or a hero.
Oh, sorry, say it again.
Or a hero.
Yes, yeah. I personally think he's done something treacherous because he's trying to blow the whistle, and that makes his legal status and his moral status very difficult.
We've talked about this a lot, John. And as far as I'm concerned, if he indeed did present illegal things and made him public, I think he had an obligation to do that.
Well, that's a tricky one, isn't it?
It sure is.
I have sympathy for Snowden on one line because he did his best to go through what we call the usual channels to try and right a wrong. And I think it's perfectly correct that the citizens of the United States should be told that their government is doing something illegal. So on that, I'm on his side. I just think the way he went about it in the end, probably in desperation, has put him the other side of the line as theoretically a traitor.
You may be right. John, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk more about the secret state right here on Coast to Coast AM. Time permitting, we'll talk a little bit about his work on the JFK assassination as well. Always fascinated by new information from other people. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. John Hughes Wilson with us, The Secret State. John, how did you get into writing?
After I'd done rather badly, I've always written all my life. Of course, as an intelligence officer, you have to write a lot of reports. And I wrote a novel on a train once going up to London. So I'd been writing for a long time. And it just sort of almost came naturally. And the publishers always say, write about what you know. So I said, can I write about sex and violence? And they said, no, write about intelligence instead. So I wrote a book about intelligence. And as I say, it's now a textbook, which to my astonishment.
All right, let's talk a little bit about what's been going on currently these days. And, of course, the big talk is, did Russia spy and hack into emails and tamper with the United States election campaign?
My reply to that, George, is do bears rush into the woods looking very thoughtful with rolls of lavatory paper? Of course they did, just like America spies on Russia, and that's why you pay the CIA and the NSA. Otherwise, what are all those $53 billion worth of taxpayers' money for? Everyone spies on everyone. It's part of humanity, and we just have to accept it.
So they get the information, then, you're saying, and they passed it on to what? Trump's campaign? What did they do with it?
Oh, well, that I don't know, and that's perfectly possible. And I would be surprised if they hadn't. I'm proving it's going to be very difficult. But certainly I believe that Russia took a very close interest in the American election. It wanted its own preferred candidate to come out. Hillary Clinton obviously wasn't it. In the same way, perhaps, that China took a close interest. Germany took a close interest, France interest. And I would also think the United Kingdom was telling its men in Washington, please let us know how the election's going and how we can influence it anyway.
Of course. That's human nature,
diplomacy.
Isn't it? It's diplomacy, human nature, everything else. Wasn't there a Brit, though, who put together some kind of secret dossier on Donald Trump?
Yes. This is Chris Steele, who was an MI6 Secret Intelligence Service man.
Like a James Bond guy, right?
Well, yeah, unlikely James Bond. I mean, he's a real James Bond, but he did a lot of work in Russia. I think he was in Moscow for 4 years. He was the man to go to on Russia. And when he left the service, the Secret Intelligence Service, what's he going to do with the rest of his retirement? Well, he's going to set up his own consultancy. The problem is when you're on the outside, as I myself know from personal experience, you lose the access to classified information. You have to go on your own contacts, your black book, what you remember, what you know, what you read in open source. And I think Steele did this and put together a dossier that was probably not up to the critical standard of a government document. He then peddles that to someone for money. I think it's originally, if I remember correctly, George, I think it's originally commissioned by Jeb Bush, who is the governor down in Florida, correct?
No. I don't think Jeb is the governor in Florida anymore.
Anymore. He was, wasn't he?
Yes,
that's right. But he's a Republican, and then it's picked up by other people, and it does the rounds, and it ends up in the hands of the Democrats. And, of course, when it pops up, everyone's very angry, particularly the Russians. So this guy has now done a runner, and no one quite knows where he is.
Is he alive?
Oh, I would hope so. I would think so. I'd be very careful, though, about drinking a cup of tea with any Russians in the near future. It might have polonium-210 in it.
Exactly. As Roger Stone claims that somebody poisoned him, he was a Trump advisor before he resigned.
Really? I didn't realize he'd been poisoned. I mean, Livichenko is the one, obviously, everyone thinks of.
Right. But, yeah, apparently that it happened. So in this particular case, did he have any goods on Mr. Trump?
I suspect he had something on Mr. Trump, and I suspect it was a mixture of truth, half-truths.
And some lies.
Possibilities. It wouldn't, as I say, be up to the standard, the critical standard of government information. And, of course, that's why he's on the run now.
How would you rate U.S. intelligence right now?
That's a very unfair question. It's the same problem you've had ever since 1947-48, when President Truman tells Walter Beadle Smith, who's Ike's ex-chief of staff, set up and become the director of Central Intelligence and have everyone reporting their intelligence to me. And that's absolutely the correct answer. What happens then, and it's partly to do with the way America works, I think, Americans are very competitive. They believe in using sharp elbows to get on in business and everything. And you then have this extraordinary thing that's blown up over the years where you have a competitive bunch of agencies, rather like medieval courtiers trying to get the king's ear. And so, and it's an American friend of mine, now dead, who worked for CIA, he called it the alphabet soup of American agencies. And before I came on the program, George, I just checked up. At the moment, you've got 17 primary intelligence agencies and no real central focus. And that's the problem.
Hmm. And even after 9/11, they really didn't join up, did they?
No. And I'm the problem here in the British system, I'm going to do a comparison here, which I think your listeners might find useful. In the British system, there is a thing called the Joint Intelligence Committee. It sits in Whitehall. It has the directors of the Secret Service, the Security Service, the Monitoring Service, the Photographic, all those. They all report once a week to Whitehall. There's a committee with an independent chairman. They listen to all the views, and they come to a consensual, collegiate line, a conclusion on what's going on. That then goes into a red book, top secret, code word, and it's passed to the Prime Minister and to ministers. Now, that's quite rightly accused sometime of being the lowest common denominator, bland, not very clear. Now, that's the way the Brits do it. The way the Americans do it is everyone's trying to get more budget, more power, more influence. So if, for example, the CIA can say, we've got a spy in the Kremlin, and the NSA says, oh, we can't get that, then the CIA pitches for more budget. So it's a competitive environment. The problem is if you're the president, whatever president, you've got this, if you like, Tower of Babel coming at you, and what's needed is one clear voice. It may be right, it may be wrong, but you to let an American president try and do his own intelligence, which is what happened at Pearl Harbor, it doesn't work.
In this era of technology, John, hacking, being able to listen in on cell phone conversations, why do we need physical spies anymore?
Human intelligence, crucial for one thing and one thing only, intentions. It's really very important that you get the intentions of what someone's going to do. Anyone can count, be a bean counter. You can count tanks from space, from satellites. I've done that. You can count how many tanks they've got. We've all done that. That's the capabilities side. But intelligence consists of two things, capabilities and intentions. And the spy can give you intentions in a way that maybe only SIGINT sometimes can compare.
Let's talk a little bit about 9/11. How could we have dropped the ball on that when so many intelligence sources were told certain things, you know, these people are training to fly planes, not to land, things like that. Why didn't anybody jump on that?
Well, again, I've got to come back to this compartmentalization of American intelligence. You had this extraordinary business where the CIA actually lifted in Malaysia, I think 1995 or 1997, something like that. They left three guys who are plotting an attack in the United States of America. The CIA hoard that information to themselves. They don't tell the FBI. They're not on any watch list. So when these three come back, come in through the states, they go to the West Coast, out to Los Angeles, I think. They shave off their beards. They run around enjoying the delights of the West Coast, fast cars, lots of drink. And in fact, they're just like a bunch of Arabs who are on the loose and having a good time in the states. The FBI don't even bother to watch them. Then you have the NSA, who've picked up 33 indications that something's going down, but they don't tell the FBI or the CIA, so no one's talking to anyone. And the other problem is you have set up a counter-terrorist cell that's quite a good thing, but all the people there were busily focusing on Afghanistan and what's going on in the Middle East. And so looking at America, It breaks down there. You could tell a piece of space junk coming in over the North Pole from Russia, a missile, but you couldn't actually see things in your own backyard because of this compartmentalization of the agencies.
Isn't that now what Homeland Security is supposed to put together?
Yes, it is. And one wonders just how good it is and whether it can actually knock heads together with the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA. And I don't believe it can.
We have now been, since this tragedy, going on 16 years in Afghanistan.
Yep.
14 years in Iraq the second time. Of course, we were in there in 91 shortly as we got got them out of Kuwait. So 14 years in Iraq. We don't have an exit plan.
No. And I don't think the Brits do either, and I don't think anybody does. There's a school of thought that says the best thing we could do is pull out completely and just let them go at it. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, that's a political judgment. And if I had to point a finger unerringly at the biggest mistake the West made, it was the invasion of Iraq in 2003, because that effectively united a huge slab of the Muslim world against the great Satan, that's you guys, and the little Satan, that's the Brits, and the whole business of Western culture. Everything leads back, as far as I'm concerned, to the decision to invade Iraq a second time. That was a big mistake.
And we're still there. And it was a mistake based on a lie.
Well, certainly in Britain. And there's a very strong movement in Britain to impeach Tony Blair, the Prime Minister, on the grounds that he lied to Parliament. And I remember it very well because I was commenting for the BBC at the time, George, and I was in Gaza at the time doing a contract in Gaza to try and teach them how to deal with explosive intelligence and things like that. And the telephone rang in my hotel room, and they said the Prime Minister just stood up and said the Iraqis do have weapons of mass destruction. What do you think of that?
Yeah.
And I said, well, the Prime Minister obviously has much better sources.
Was he misled by our president?
No. He was deliberately misled the Joint Intelligence Committee, and that's why they've got egg on their face at the moment.
Gosh.
The chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee, a man called John Scarlett, who was an MI6 man, which was always a mistake. Better to have a judge there instead. The MI6 man did exactly what Blair told him. I suspect, well, he either didn't have the balls or the moral courage to tell the truth, or he was looking for preferment, and he certainly got it because shortly afterwards he was made head of MI6 and given a knighthood.
See,
but he basically twisted the intelligence thing to do what Blair told him to do.
And then, and one of the mistakes we made going into Iraq was once we went in there and there was no resistance. I mean, I kept thinking to myself, these people put their guns down, took their uniforms off,
mm-hmm.
and they just kind of meshed in with the society. The mistake we made was that they had jobs. You know, they were teachers, they were doctors, they were professionals, they were in the military, they did it all. And when we came in and tossed out Saddam, they lost all their jobs.
That's right. Well, I think the mistake there was probably somewhere in the councils of state. They didn't actually look at the Ba'ath Party in Iraq, which ran Iraq, a one-party state, and they put into action what was essentially a model of the denazification program after the Second World War. Now, that was a huge mistake because Iraq was run by the Ba'ath Party, and suddenly any officer over the rank of major, you're out of work, no money. If you're an academic and you were a member of the Ba'ath Party, you lose your job. There was no plan to run Iraq afterwards, after the war. That's the big mistake.
No plan and no exit strategy.
Correct. Absolutely.
I mean, their plan was to stay there indefinitely, and we still are.
Yeah. It's what's that lovely American expression in the Deep South? It's what they call a tar baby.
And you're stuck to it.
Yep, but you're stuck to the tar baby. And unless we get something really bold and decisive, and Donald Trump actually might be the man to do that.
He might be.
Yeah, I mean,
he's
a different, he's not a politician in the accepted sense. He may come in and say, right, I'm going to cut the Gordian knot. We're going to withdraw and leave these guys to sort themselves out.
Can these
Donald
people?
Trump, he'll probably say, we leave these ragheads to sort themselves out, something like that.
Can these people defend themselves if we just pulled out?
Well, that's a very good question, and that's one of the awful problems that politicians, that's why we pay politicians to do their job. They've got to make that decision.
because there, I'm sure, when we pulled out of Vietnam, South Vietnam, and the North came in.
Yep.
I'm sure they killed a lot of people that were, you know, South Vietnamese and sympathetic to the South Vietnamese government.
Oh yes, and if you were an American collaborator or Quisling, that's the North Vietnamese view. You went into a camp, you were interrogated, and a lot of them were actually executed.
Yes.
So there comes an awful moment when you have to abandon your friends, perhaps for a different need.
So when you look at your book, The Secret State, tell me, give me an overview of what you want people to come away with when they read this.
Oh, what a good question. Yes, I would like to think I had such a profound view when I set out to write it, but it's a very good question. I think the answer is I would like people to come away, George, with an understanding of what intelligence can do and what it cannot do. And the cherry on top of the sundae is the realization that in a democracy, the politicians have to take responsibility.
A lot of responsibility.
Yeah. And if you're a politician, the outgoing head of the Mossad, the last outgoing head, he gave a talk on leaving office.
And for people who don't know, that's the Israeli
intelligence. I'm sorry, yes, the Israeli Secret Service. And he said, coordinator of intelligence, and he said on outgoing, his biggest problem was going to politicians and saying to the politicians, this is happening, I don't know, Iran is building a nuclear bomb. What are your critical intelligence requirements, minister? And the minister would say, I don't know. What should they be? You tell me. And it's very difficult to get politicians in a democracy to be clear and say what they actually want to know. They'll do it in a panic when things go wrong, but they don't like to commit resources when they're, if you like, fly fishing.
You know spies. You've come across spies.
I've caught one.
You've caught a spy?
Oh, yes.
Was he a Brit?
A long time ago, in another life, I was sitting quietly in SHAPE, Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, part of NATO, known to its friends as Superb Holidays at Public Expense. And the guy walked into my office one day. He said, can I borrow the tank file on Russian tanks? We were in a big top secret area. And I said, sure. But it hadn't come back on Tuesday. That was on the Friday. And I mentioned it to someone else. He said, he's always borrowing my files as well.
Uh-huh.
So I went to see the security officer, who just happened to be another Brit in the intelligence corps. So we kind of, what's that lovely American expression? We did an end run on the chain of command.
Mm-hmm.
And the chain of command didn't know. And they investigated him. They called in the Dutch Secret Service, because he was a Dutch officer. And eventually he was found that he was spying. He was taken away by the Dutch, and eventually he was allowed to disappear to his employers. And his employers were Mossad. He was spying on NATO for Israel.
Interesting. Now, was he paid? Is that their motivation?
No. I think he had been caught in a honey trap when he was a Dutch observer out in Gaza or in Lebanon. Before, and I think he'd probably been in a honey trap there, and he had a beautiful wife who's a Jewess, who turned out later, according to my Dutch contacts, to have been his case officer.
With so many nations supporting Israel, why would they want to spy?
Another very perceptive question. Well, I've never said this on the air before, but I'm now going to tell you the truth. A long time ago, a friend of mine took me to one side. He was American. He worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency, one of this alphabet soup. And he took me to one side and put me in the corner. He said, John, you screwed up one of the best operations we ever had. And I said, what do you mean? He said, why do you think we were passing stuff to Israel? Get real. I've never said that in public before.
Wow. Well, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment. I want to talk with you about your work, JFK, an American coup d'etat. And we'll take phone calls as well with everything we've been talking about.